Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Freynes at the controls this morning. We are hoping in this second hour of Focus 580 to be talking with Dr. Aruna Roy. She is a social and political activist from India visiting the campus here. She gave a talk last night and was going to be talking with us about some of her activity. And she is not here yet, and I'm not really quite sure whether she's going to be here in time for us to have the conversation with her that we had planned. We'll see if we can hang on here for another minute or two, and then we may have to go ahead and run an archive. It does give me the opportunity, though, to mention some of the upcoming programs that we have here on Focus 580. For tomorrow, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Michael Quincy. He is a specialist in automobiles for the folks at Consumer Reports. And once again, they have put out their annual issue rating new cars. And so that's what we'll be talking about tomorrow in the first hour, talking a little bit about those cars that they think are good, about the certain kinds of features that people value in cars, among other things like mileage and safety. So if you're thinking about a car, they also have some advice, too, on the kind of strategies that you should take to think about how it is you go and you negotiate your price. So all of that, we'll talk about new cars tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour with folks from Consumer Reports, or someone from Consumer Reports. Then in the second hour, we'll talk about the continuing tension in the relationship between Iran and the United States. And there our guest will be Dr. Dariush Zahidi. He's a lecturer in political science at the University of California at Berkeley. He'll be joining us tomorrow by telephone, and so that's what we have for tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you each week, and we always give people the opportunity to call in here and make comments and ask questions. Well, we are pleased here to have with us in the studio Dr. Aruna Roy. She is our guest for this hour of Focus 580. She is a political and social activist from India and is here visiting the campus and gave a talk last night. This was the Daniel Sanders lecture. It's been going on now for a number of years. This was the 15th annual a lecture every year that honors the memory and the contributions of Daniel Sanders, who was at one time head of the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois. We're pleased that she could be here to spend a little bit of time with us and talk. And of course, as always, as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. The number, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line if you're interested in calling in and if it would be a long-distance call for you, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Just that little silver knob that's on the front of that box there.
That one right there.
Is the volume control for your headphones.
Thank
so
you.
Feel free to adjust that if you want to either turn it up or turn it down. And that way, if we have some callers, you will hear them. And, of course, you will hear both of us that way through the headphones. Well, I'm very pleased that you could be with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Perhaps I might ask a little bit about you. I do know that going back now a number of years, I guess, to the 1970s, you worked in the Indian Civil Service. And that was after a period of time there that you left that work and became involved in the kind of community work that that you still do. And maybe I would be interested in having you talk a little bit about your experiences working in government and why it is that obviously you felt frustrated and perhaps felt that there would be a different something that you could do that would make more of a contribution. And so you left your government job. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences in government and then why you left?
Well, I'll talk about two major issues. There are so many things, actually, that makes you take a decision. Mm-hmm. The first thing is that if you really want to work for change, you can't work it through a bureaucracy. Nowhere in the world and the history of the world has a bureaucracy ever worked for radical change. The bureaucracy is always there to maintain the status quo. And if you have a good bureaucracy, then it'll implement the laws of the land. That's as far as it can get. So one of the reasons why I left was because I felt that the work that needed to be done to change the face of rural and poor India needed to be done without limitations of postings, transfers, and all the various shackles that are there in part of administration. The second thing is that there is a lot of corruption, as you know, in civil services in India. And I thought that the one way that you could fight the corruption would be through citizens' participation in understanding governments and how that they function, not within the civil service. So these were the two major reasons I left, because I wanted really to work for basic change.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about your experiences in Rajasthan, where you, I understand you still do live, right? But also, and I just want to mention something that at some point we'll get into some detail, but something that certainly you have been very much involved in, and your name has been associated with the effort within India to have a more open government and give people access to government records and information, like, imperfect as it may be here in the United States, the Freedom of Information Act. It apparently was your very strong feeling that as a way of empowering people, they needed to have access to know what government officials, particularly, I guess, local government officials, were doing. And the only way to hold those people accountable is if you can have openness. You can look at official records and documents to find out what people are doing, and particularly, are they doing what they say that they are doing? And this is something that apparently before was not true. Was India particularly, do you think, Indian government particularly secretive?
Actually, the British left us an Official Secrets Act, you know, which can be used even to prevent you from seeing an electoral list if the official so pleases. So we needed a Right to Information Act to contravene and overrule the Official Secrets Act, even legally. We do have Article 19(1)(a) of the Constitution of India, which gives us the freedom of right to expression. But right to expression is only possible if you have the right to know. So we needed a right to know, which overrode these colonial acts that still exist in India. But the Right to Information campaign, as we call it in India, and the National Campaign for People's Right to Information, is really to fight corruption and the arbitrary use of power, both these things which are part of bureaucratic mismanagement. And Rajiv Gandhi, when he was Prime Minister of India, said that if he sends down 1 rupee, which has got 100 paise, only 15 paise reaches the village. So if all development money goes into corruption, then where is the infrastructure building? Where is the minimum wage? Where is the right to health, to food, to security, to housing? So for us, it was a vital need. And the slogan that we really used was the right to know, the right to live, because the right to know really is linked for 60% of India with the right to live. So we needed to see these records just to live properly, to live with dignity. And the other thing, the other slogan was our money, our accounts. Public money is our money. So no government has the right to say we can't see the accounts. In a democracy, and in an Indian democracy, the Constitution says we are the sovereign and people who rule us are our servants. Yeah. So we needed to know.
Well, maybe I just go on and ask some more questions about this and give you an opportunity to talk about it. There had been an effort in several states for the state government to adopt this. And then eventually there was a national law that went into effect last fall for all of India, but I gather that that still depends on the cooperation of the state governments, because they're the ones that's where people go. Wherever they live, they go to their state government and make their requests for information to the state government.
Actually, there is a national law, as you say, which got implemented on the 13th of October last year, which is your autumn and fall. The state government, I mean, every person doesn't go to the national government to Delhi to file an application. You file it at your local level. But the state government is obliged under the Act to display suo moto, which is on its own, lots of information publicly on its walls, to paint them on a board outside its office, to facilitate people. Now, this is mandatory under the law. So there, every office is obliged, no matter whether it's a state government office or a central government office, whether it's at the village or it's the district level or at the state level or the national level, to do so. The state has a play where it has to institute an information commission now and a state information commissioner. Mm-hmm. Now, that's where there are problems, because the state information commissioners in many states have not been appointed. Information commissions have not been set up. In some states where information commissioners have been appointed, there are ex-civil servants with not very clean reputations. And in most of the cases, I would say 99% of the cases, people appointed are ex-civil servants. So though the law allows for people with a good public record to become an information commissioner, as you can see, the bureaucracy has worked it so that it's only the retired civil servants who go in, and it's a five-year tenure. You have to be under 65, and the civil servants retire at 60. So it's very convenient.
Yeah. So this went into effect in October of last year.
Yes.
I suppose one would say that these kinds of things do take time to get worked out. So maybe you would not expect things to be working perfectly by this point, not very many months later. Do you think that things are indeed moving in the right moving in the right direction?
I think they're phenomenal things. For the first time in India, we are seeing an accountable government. You know, very poor people are applying for information, getting replies from district collectors or very senior officers. I applied for information and I did not go within the 30-day stipulated period. There's a very interesting clause in the Act that if the official doesn't give you the information within 30 days and keeps silent, that's deemed refusal, then there's a penalty on that official personally to pay ₹250 per day for denial of information. So they're worried. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, there's an Act which penalizes a civil servant for delay, for inaction, and for deliberate mismanagement. So they are worried. So we have information applications being replied to. Poor people who haven't had rations for years have had their backlog, recovered their backlog, and they've got the information as well. An old man who didn't get grain for 12 months has got grain. A chief minister who's misused public funds to put up hoardings with her own photograph. The hoardings have come down in Rajasthan when we wanted to know under what budget the particular department of the government had put up these hoardings and which was the advertising agency which they had engaged to put up these hoardings. So there are all sorts of varied experiences in India, and there are also problems.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think that this is very interesting because it becomes clear the more examples you give just how important this is. But I would think that on the face of it, some people might be surprised that if your ultimate goal was to improve the lives of poor people, the idea of something like freedom of information might seem, on the face of it, might seem a strange thing to be working for. And yet, as you say, when you start to give examples, you start to see, oh, now I begin to see just how useful this can be, particularly when you're looking at corruption on a relatively low level. I mean, that is in a sense of a local, local officials, local politicians. And it may be that there's corruption running all the way up to the national government. But, you know, the place where people most come on into contact with government is going to be just right in their community on the local level. Maybe you could give some other examples of ways in which this now increased access to information has been used and to try to better people's lives.
Well, I'll tell you, one is the hospital. We don't know what medicines we can get free. We need a board outside to tell us what medicines are given free, what kind of categories of people are entitled to it. We need to know what is in the register, what is in the storeroom. Why, when you have anti-snake serum in the storeroom, am I made to go and buy the anti-snake serum outside when I don't have money in my pocket as a poor person? I need to know why the school teacher is not attending the school. Who is the school teacher anyway? And when this was asked in Western Rajasthan, we found that the school teacher was actually subcontracting the school to another man. He was earning ₹6,000, but he was subcontracting it for ₹2,000 to somebody else. And he was not attending school. We need to know why the revenue official has not paid us our dues. What's prevented him? We need to know why minimum wages, which was due to us on a particular work site where we worked for a government work, has not been paid. For the first time in a tribal area in interior Rajasthan, for the first time, officials visited the village. They came with the muster rolls, the labor lists that they're asked to see, and the payment, and delivered it to the people. It's all sorts of things which will benefit very ordinary citizens in their interface with the government for daily needs. Mm. It's rations, it's schooling, it's health, it's wages, it's employment. Why is my name not on the list? I am one of the poor people. Why is my name not on the list? When we unearthed muster rolls and labor lists before in our campaign, when we were struggling for it, we found dead people's names on the muster rolls. People had been dead for years so that the money could be siphoned off. We found bills and vouchers which were false bills and vouchers, so that money could be siphoned off. When it's in the public domain, it's very difficult to be corrupt. You can bribe a police official, you can bribe an anti-corruption department official, you can bribe the vigilance department official, but you can't bribe people.
And I'm assuming that the kind of problem that you're talking about is not just a problem in Rajasthan, where you live, but it's a problem it's everywhere, all over in India.
It is all over India, yes.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Aruna Roy. She is a community activist from India and has been particularly associated with this effort that here we've been talking about over a number of years now in India to provide people access to official government documents as a way of trying to get at and fight corruption. The act, the National Act, came into effect last year in October. And before that, in some number of states, they had been doing this on the state level. And I think was indeed Rajasthan the first place?
No, Rajasthan was not the first place. It was Tamil Nadu, which was the first state which passed the law in 96.
That's where you grew up, wasn't it?
No, I belonged to Tamil Nadu, but I didn't grow up
there. Oh, okay. My apologies there. I thought I read something about the fact that you were you were from there.
I'm from there, yes.
Oh, all right. Well, in any case, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but it was, and that's all the way in the south, down in the southern,
that's right.
The southern tip of India. It was the first place to do this. And it was, when was this?
In 96, and it was a bad act.
It
was a very bad act.
Because it didn't work well?
No, it was like an office order. It was not like a law.
All right. And then was Rajasthan the second?
The fourth, I think. Rajasthan, there was, after Tamil Nadu, there was Goa. The Goa Act was a good act. Mm-hmm. And then there was Madhya Pradesh, and then there was Rajasthan, then there was Maharashtra, then there was Delhi, then there was Assam, and so on and so forth, yeah.
Hmm. Is this something that has gotten support from the current government? Have they said that they think that this is something that's important?
Actually, we have, in this whole Right to Information campaign, we've learned how to use advocacy with political parties and the government. So we have always demanded that it be in their manifestos. So the present government in power in Delhi had it in its manifesto that it would give us a better right to information law. So when they won the elections, they brought out a document called the National Common Minimum Program, in which they promised that they would improve the law. Then they set up a National Advisory Council under the chairmanship of Sonia Gandhi. And they invited me to be a member of that council to monitor the National Common Minimum Program. So I am in the National Advisory Council. So I had access to the formulation of the way the law was being made. So I accessed throughout the process, not really once the law was made. But every time there was bureaucratic intervention, I knew what the law was going to be like. So eventually I fed it into the campaign. And the campaign then used it. So we now have a very good law because of the political commitment to it and the way civil society groups and the campaigns have used them to pressure them to keep political commitments made. Mm-hmm. That's accountability for us. And it's also important in the democratic process.
Our guest, Dr. Aruna Roy, he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She gave a talk yesterday evening. That was the 15th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture, a series that's been going on now for a number of years on the campus to honor the memory of Dan Sanders, who was at one time head of the School of Social Work. Questions here, by the way, are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You did mention the fact that there has a relatively new government in India that which is now, again, it's a coalition government, but it's the Congress Party that's leading the government, which had been for a long time the dominant party in Indian politics from independence up until, well, I guess maybe it was about 10, 15 years ago. What year did the BJP?
About 18 years ago.
And then the BJP was in power for a long time. And finally, everybody, I think, was kind of surprised by the last election in which Congress essentially became the leader again in politics. And I think that some of the analysis was that the BJP had talked a lot about just how wonderful everything was for everybody. Was it India rise?
India shining.
That was sort of the campaign slogan, talking about just how wonderful everything was there and how many people had benefited from the economic development of the country. And apparently, in fact, not enough people felt that had. They said that that was sort of an empty slogan. And for that reason, BJP lost ultimately and Congress came back. Where did that kind of dissatisfaction with how India's development was benefiting people, where did that come from? Was that mostly middle-class people, or was that indeed people who had even less than that?
Actually, India didn't shine for the poor at all. It's still not shining, but it shone even less because all the policies that, the Sensex is the figures of the shares going up in Bombay. People felt very happy with Sensex figures. But what does a poor man care? He has no shares. He doesn't even have a minimum wage. He doesn't have food in his belly. So India's voters, the majority of India's voters, are people who are working class or poor people. The middle class doesn't vote in such large numbers. It's the working class that really votes. And it feels important because at least at one day in 5 years, you can exercise your power to say whom you want, in power at least. So the mandate of the poor, it's the mandate of the poor. And that's why this party has been forced to recognize that they have to somehow deliver what they have promised to the poor of India. And I think that is also the mandate of people like us, who are social activists, who have found some amount of democratic space to find for policy changes, that we will work our level best to see what we can get through this present government for the poor through their own mandate. So if they've made a mandate, they've said yes, we want to ensure that they do it. And that's part of democracy and democratic accountability for us.
I do wonder how people think in India about what they think about all that has been written now about its growth, development, and potential as a future kind of economic superpower. It is indeed talked of in that sort of a way, that if we look out maybe 10, 20, 30 years, that India, along with China, perhaps Brazil, perhaps some other places, is talked about as being one of the biggest and most powerful economies in the world. I wonder when people in India hear that kind of thing, what it is they think about that and whether indeed they think that has anything to do really with them.
It's mixed. I wouldn't say that, India doesn't have the potential. Of course, it has the potential. We are very, not more than anybody else, but an intelligent lot of people. We apply ourselves. We are hardworking. It's true that we can do it, but with the kind of agenda that's coming, there is a lot of critiquing and criticism. We can't just be buyers and market-based alone. We need to strengthen our production. We need to see that we produce and that the producing units don't disintegrate. We have to prevent our farmers from committing suicide, which they're doing in large numbers today. We have to ensure that small units of production don't close up. We have to ensure that small industry doesn't close up. We have to see that big industry that exists gets strengthened. We can't sell out completely, as perhaps some of the market forces would like us to do, and just to be a selling and buying country. We can't do that. Even in terms of software, there is a huge boom, as you know. But we would like to know whether we can really have something to do with hardware, where we can produce, where not only use those stuff. Today, outsourcing to India is cheap, so India is okay. Supposing tomorrow there's another country which is cheaper, all the multilateral companies will just shift. What happens to us? So we need to control our economies. So there's a huge debate on, and a very healthy debate in my country, as to what should be within the control of the national economies and economy, and how much can actually be let free for outside intervention and take over. Mm-hmm. It's a huge argument, and not all of us agree with Mr. Manmohan Singh, nor do we agree with our planning commission. And so there's debate. But the one thing that I will say is very healthy is that there are economists ranging on either side, and the newspapers are full of arguments and debates on these issues. So the general public knows that there are both sides of the coin.
Let's talk with a caller, someone who was listening in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted you to sketch out some of the scope of the grassroots movements that have been going on. Like, I think Rajasthan is one of the places where Coca-Cola was protested because of both their drilling affecting the water table and I think because of just producing apparently a bad product with contaminants in it, not having enough whatever it took to keep their product even good. And then the other thing that I know that's going on is the dams that are being protested that are displacing many internally displaced Indians, and those are both grassroots movements that we don't that have been massive in scope that we don't see much about here. It's maybe not unusual because I guess protests are not reported too much. I think 250,000 people protested Bush's coming to India and Bombay and about 100,000 in Delhi, and he wasn't able to talk in the Lok Sabha, the parliament, because they knew there would be protests there even. So even some of the politicians are not aboard to follow the line. As you say, there's a lot more dissent, it seems. And we usually don't hear but a very one-dimensional reporting if we hear anything at all. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to respond to that?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Well, actually, I was part of the Coca-Cola agitation and I got arrested one time. So I know that these things are important. And in a country where you can't get milk when children are dying of malnutrition and where there's no water in a state like Rajasthan and our groundwater table is falling rapidly, to give a company like Coca-Cola rights to tap groundwater is criminal. And the local panchayat did not want Coca-Cola to get the license to be renewed. So in that protest, people were with us and the local council didn't want it. And the law says that the local council doesn't want it. It can't be forced. But the pressures of economic liberalization are such that all kinds of things are waived. That's why it has got to be a political battle. And that's why all of us now realize that we need to know why certain decisions are taken and how they can contravene the law. That so far as Coca-Cola is concerned, it's a large issue. I cannot talk too long, so I won't go into it. And you know, Kerala has already fought on that issue. I don't know whether you're an Indian or not, but if you're Indian, you know that Kerala has had a big problem and they fought the battle of Coca-Cola and got them out. That's one thing. And the second thing about the big dams, we're trying now to see, you know, that we have lost at many levels. The Supreme Court has ruled against us. The politicians are arranged against us. And these big dams and these big projects will go through unless we can expose how these big projects are going to harm not only poor people, but it's technologically flawed, that it's management, it's not management ethics. And in Delhi, we had a huge battle against the privatization of drinking water. And what we managed to do in that was take out information and put it on in the public domain, 4,000 sheets of paper, and by which publicly, including people who were rich, affluent, who thought normally that people like us who protested were anti-development, were convinced that it was technological flawed to privatize water supply in Delhi, that the Indian Institute of Technology alumni offered its services to set it right. The institutes of management in India said that it was flawed. So we need to take all these matters into the public domain, and that's why right to information is so important, that it doesn't remain something which is projected as an anti or pro issue, but that we rationally understand it. So far as the media is concerned, of course it blocks it out. Many of us were in the anti-Bush protest. And you know that it's not only in India but abroad when you have these huge anti the person in the president or prime minister in power when there's protests against them. Media blocks it out. When it's something else, it gets attention. And that raises the other huge debate about who controls the media. What do you see? Is it correct? Is it accurate? How much of it is managed? How much of it is monitored? How much of it is propaganda? How much of it is information? And I can't go into it. But this is a huge debate. And I'm glad you asked the question. But I think civil society needs to talk a little more about it and ask questions in the public domain.
I wanted to mention that there is an active group on the campus here trying to follow the University of Michigan's lead in getting Coke, getting their pouring rights contract either canceled or terminated when it comes up for renewal. And also, curiously enough, the cities here and the university are talking about re-municipalizing our private water system. So I think we have to catch up with India, it seems, a little some places. Thank you.
I would really be glad if you could get in touch with us and let us know what's going on in India.
Questions, again, are welcome as we continue to talk with Dr. Aruna Roy. She's a community activist, social political activist from India. She is here visiting the campus, gave a talk last night. Questions are welcome, certainly, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd be interested in having you talk a little bit about this organization that you started, you and other people started, in English, I guess it's translated as the Association of Workers and Peasants. How did you come to start this organization? And that was also in Rajasthan, is that right?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It was in Rajasthan. You see, let me put it like this, that when parliamentary democracy and representative democracy fails to deliver, and when representatives get into parliaments and assemblies and local councils and do something that's anti-people, then there is a question about how we can get involved in reclaiming democratic institutions and democratic spaces. And in this whole debate, there's been a birth of many organizations who call themselves non-party people's political organizations. Mm-hmm. And in India, there's a huge number, of which one is the MKSS. So when it came to be, we don't take any institutional funding either from India or abroad. We live very simply. We live in village huts, actually. And we maintain ourselves on a very, very small budget. And the idea was to sit and talk to people and get them to realize that if they do not use democratic processes and occupy the spaces which democracy gives us to monitor and look after ourselves and impact the political process, we will lose out. And with that intention, we went and settled in central Rajasthan. But we began with what are people's issues. You cannot begin with an abstract idea. So it was unemployment. It was not non-payment of minimum wages. It was non-delivery of services. It was lack of access to education and health. So we built, and with sexual abuse, with violence. So we took all these issues up and worked with people, whatever the issues were, while all the time talking about the need to mobilize, the need to come together, the need to form an organization, the need to know how to impact democracy, need to how to protest, how to, in peaceful means of protest, we've inherited from Gandhi, how to use them, how to sit on strikes, to picket, and the lot.
And you've been living there and have been doing this now for, probably more over 20 years.
No, about 16 years.
Oh, 16 years. Okay.
In this particular place, yes.
Yeah. Had at any point along that line, had you thought about standing for a parliament, for example, to get involved in government that way, to seek elective office and get involved in government in that way?
Well, it's been a matter of great debate and curiosity so far as the press is concerned, certainly in India. They all wondered why we people who talk this kind of language don't get into electoral politics. Mm-hmm. But it's a chicken and egg issue, if you know what I mean. I'll never get elected to power because the ways and means of getting elected to power in India today are whether you are a particular community-based, caste-based individual, then you get votes or you have to use other means. So first we in the MKSS want to establish that you can get elected without using illegal or unethical means. So we have worked with some of our local people getting elected to the village council with manifestos promising transparency and complete access to all records and to decision making, and saying that we will not bring you to the election booth, we will not bribe you to cast your vote, and we've succeeded. Now that is light at the far end of a very long tunnel. But it does give us hope that the cleansing of the electoral process will enable people with people like us also sometimes to stand for election. I personally may not, but many others in the MKSS may stand for election at some point of time to the state council to begin with, after the village council, the district council, the state council. Then one day maybe for parliament. But it's a matter of a debate amongst organizations like ours in India and how to engage with electoral politics. And actually, I also belong to an organization called the People's Political Front, which has been put up by a lot of people's movements together. And they are wondering whether they should stand for the elections in Maharashtra. So, and what form it'll take, we don't know. So these things are under debate. And because without engaging with electoral politics, we lose out in the long run because it's parliament and state assemblies that take decisions that affect us.
Yeah. Well, it certainly strikes me that because of the work that you have done, the recognition that you've received, particularly having been involved in the effort for the Openness in Government Act, that you do have a national, I know I recognize India is a big place, but you do have a kind of a national standing back home in India. That seemed to be that would be the kind of thing you could build a run for office on if you decided that's the way that you wanted to go.
I think before we run for office, we'll have to create the grounds for not political alternatives, but alternative politics, which means politics with ethics, politics with transparency, politics with people, where the leader is not seen as a single great phenomenon, but as somebody who is one of many who has a role to play and is absolutely accountable to people in the group. And if that happens, yes, maybe, but not me. Maybe not me, maybe somebody else. But yes, people like us.
Yeah. We have some other folks to talk with here. Let's talk with someone who's listening in Savoy, nearby, on line number one. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I would like to ask Ms. Roy to comment on going back the last 10, 15 years. I mean, I'm an Indian. I've been living in the U.S. for about 10-plus years. I want to know from her about the social impact of the economic liberalization process, especially on the middle and lower middle class, and also on the topic of the multinational companies coming into India, doing business in India, which affects the local way of life. And also, my last point is, what is the impact, apart from the multinational companies, you also have different shades and varieties of religious organizations coming into India, trying to convert or whatnot. I would just like for her to address those couple of issues, and I will hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Well, I think the opening up of the market has been indiscriminate. And I think a lot of economic liberties of ordinary people has been adversely affected. And it's a mandate on which we do not agree as a group with the present government or the previous government. And we will continue to protest and we will continue to look for ways in which they can be stopped. Because if you look at the farmers' suicides, there are middle-level farmers who are committing suicide in Andhra Pradesh, in Punjab, in many other parts of the country, including Rajasthan. There's discontent because even when you produce properly, you don't get bank loans. You're not able to sell your market produce because grain is coming in cheaper than what you can sell for. And, well, there are innumerable problems. And now we are opening up retail markets. That means all the small manufacturers of chips, of all sorts of small things that we produce in India are going to be adversely affected. And we are getting shocking. We're getting rakhis, which are made in China, which normally were made by women who are destitute, poor women. We are getting Banarsi saris, which was such a speciality, woven in China. Why should we wear Banarsi saris woven in China? This is an old Indian tradition which has been woven for years. What will happen to all those weavers? What will happen to their lives? It's a huge question. And I think a very, very disturbing one. I don't have time to get into it. But we do not want indiscriminate liberalization. We do not want markets being opened up, which will kill the economic livelihood of our own people. And we protest against it. And this, I think, is lower middle class and it's the poor. But insofar as religious organizations are concerned, I would say that I'm far more afraid of the right-wing fundamentalist groups that are coming up in all the religions in India, including the Hindus. And I would say whether it's the Hindus or the Muslims or the Christians, rising fundamentalism is a threat to democracy. It's a threat to equality. It's a threat to social justice. And it's a threat to the culture of India, which is multiracial, it's multireligious, and it's pluralistic. So at that level, I think many of us want to fight. We want religion, yes. Each religion for its own. And there's beauty in each religion. We don't have to either excommunicate one or destroy the other or protest. And if there are voluntary conversions, why shouldn't there be voluntary conversions? We change political parties if someone changes a religion. Why not?
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's talk with someone else here in Danville. This is line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Ms. Royce, and I like the way she deals with a lot of the problems of poor people in the world and on a down-to-earth basis. I was wondering if there's anything in the works on her level in some way of balancing out human population with our resource base, you know, in order to make a carrying capacity for people that could be affected by some world commission or something, or in some way, you know, I'm trying to eliminate some of these byproduct problems she deals with of population and overuse of the resource base with, you know, legal aspects of it, laws and governance.
Well, actually, I think, you know, that the world is becoming smaller, and we all, and actually one of the reasons why I've come as well so far away from home, because I now realize that since the world is shrinking and there is a kind of globalization which unites all sorts of other factors,
yeah,
we have to get together as well, and we must see how we can. And I think we must begin where we are. And I think to help each other out, we have to see that the place where we are located, we raise the voice for social justice and equality. And somewhere we can join hands only if we do that locally. And there are some things in which I think research helps. We would like to know, for instance, there is the National Security Archives in Washington, through which we have got resource information about what India is signing away or signing with or signing for with the U.S. We don't get this information in India, but we can access it through the National Security Archives.
Do you think people will ever establish like a carrying capacity that would render a, you know, an adequate resource for all the inhabitants of Earth?
I think why not?
I mean, can we do? I mean, do you think we can do that before we go too far in the other direction? You know, with too many people.
I think we should. I think we have to. And with global warming and so many other horrors right around the corner, with the fact that we can destroy ourselves,
yes,
there's some crazy person who just pushes a button, we are all dead.
And
of course we have to join hands and we have to establish this caring, but how? That's the question.
I'd like to hear you a little more commentary from you on that subject, because I highly respect your opinion. I think it's a thing that's necessary and yet seldom ever talked about it at world levels, you know. And I'll hang up now and let you comment, please. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I think one thing that we can do is establish through the net, at least, a connectivity, because that's something now that enables us all to talk to each other and begin talking about common concerns and talking about issues in which we could somehow relate with each other and somehow impact the public domain. I keep going back to the public domain, because unless our voices get heard and unless there is acceptance of that voice and then there are large numbers, it doesn't somehow get conveyed into policy and political decision making. So we have to use democracy, we have to use policy making, we have to use people, and we have to make people understand that everybody has a role to play in changing the world. It cannot be done by proxy, it has to be done by each individual contributing a little bit. And how do we get this message across? It's a challenge to you, challenge to me, and challenge to all of us who care.
Another caller here. This is Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Hello. This is a question for Dr. Roy about, I guess I'm wondering, it's interesting that she was able to accomplish quite a bit through this movement, and she isn't really referring to who was in power at any particular time. It seemed more that rather whether it was this party or that party, that the accountability itself was what kept things working. I don't really see that happening, at least at a national level in the United States. And I wondered, you know, just her thoughts on that. You know, how does that work, that it doesn't really matter, or maybe I'm reading too much into it, which party in control, that the accountability comes anyway?
Actually, you're right. We have lots of folk stories in Rajasthan which we sort of relate to each other as to how it really doesn't matter, because as you sit on the same seat of power, the color changes of the individual, no matter which person you send there. Somehow when they go there, they seem to change. We always say that you're people's representative till you go in. Then you become your own representative and you leave people at the doorstep. So in any case, accountability is across parties. Accountability is governance. Accountability is the state with its own people. And it's a people who should demand that no matter who is in power, no matter it's a political party I voted for, I don't like, when the person sits there, they are accountable to me. And
I'm sorry, I was going to say that it seems that at least here we have a problem where If the label is right, it doesn't seem to matter what one party does or the other. That party is correct no matter what they do. I mean, at least that's what I'm observing. Did you see some of that, and how did you get past that?
You see, in this we have Gandhi, and I really go back to Mohanchand Karamchand Gandhi, the original Gandhi, Gandhiji as we call him in India, who said that there cannot be any compromise on means and ends. If you want ethics, you have to be ethical. And if we do something wrong, we will have to have the courage to go out and say, we've done something wrong, my political party has done something wrong, my ideology has made this mistake, and we won't do it again. But if we protect our ideological commitments or our parties, then we go the way of all flesh. And there's something that we now understand, that somewhere the bottom line is ethics, and you really cannot have ethical conveniences, or you cannot compromise on it, and you can't say, just because it's my party in power, I'll keep quiet. You simply cannot. And that's where I think there's increasing civil society mobilization in India, and people are understanding that this is a basic. And we have seen, and we have lots of stories in India as to which, I mean, I don't have the time to tell you, but we understand that no matter what party is in power, certain things simply don't happen. And the bureaucracy is a permanent bureaucracy. It doesn't change. It always manipulates, it always misrepresents, and it always suppresses. And it always does what it wants to do. So there is the permanent government, and that government has to be transparent and accountable.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you. We certainly have time for perhaps one or two more callers if people want to call very quickly and talk with our guest, Dr. Aruna Roy, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd be interested in hearing you talk about ways in which you think that Gandhi, his spirit, his ideas continue to motivate people today, continue to be alive, and that you see that if not in Indian politics, at least in people who do the kind of community work that you do.
I think Gandhi was a phenomenon so far as many things were concerned. I don't agree with everything he said. I cannot because I'm born many years later. Many things have changed. And I'm sure if he was alive today, he would have liked to have me disagree with him, because he was a rationalist in many ways. So he would have liked me to have disagreed. But there are certain principles he held dear. One was that he believed in transparency. He said that if I can't go to the rooftops and shout what I believe in, then there's something wrong with what I think if I'm in public life. It's true. He also gave a lot of space for dissent, even in his own magazine, which he brought out, when eminent people disagreed with him. Whether it was Rabindranath Tagore, whether it was Ambedkar, whether it was M.N. Roy, they were published in his newspaper along with what he said. He allowed people to hear both sides of the question in debate. And many people may not have agreed with him. Nehru disagreed with him. But it was public debate. And I think I understand now that for a real kind of public opinion to form, which is based on real values and real information, you must allow for dissent. Place for dissent is part of democracy. And I think he gave it to us. And many of us, you cannot, in India, you can't gag us. We are a talking people. And the worst thing you can do to us is say, you can't speak out your mind, we'll commit suicide. So that, I think, he recognized and probably built on. So the place for dissent is something Gandhi has given us. And also the means of civil disobedience, which, of course, the world has accepted today. How you can really protest without using violence. Because if you use violence, I don't have anything against people using violence, but they're on a very moral ground. But if you look at it in even practical, in a practical manner, violence begets violence, and then there is no end. So you have to use means which are legal, which are democratic, and which allow for the ability to heal and be kind to each other. So I don't think one uses violence, and he gave us means to fight intolerance, injustice in a very, very wonderful way.
I'm trying to get one more caller here. The time remains in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, Ms. Roy. This has been a real discussion of issues. And as you know, there are many other movements in India, like Naxalites and other such organizations, radical left-wing and right-wing, who are so concerned about the centuries of oppression that no matter what, they think that whoever comes to power will work against the people, and the only way to change really is through violence. How do you approach these people, constituencies?
Well, actually, we do have dialogue with many of the extremist groups that have now were once part of the violent, who believed in violence and are now stepping into the democratic mode. See, I don't really have any theoretical condemnation of people, because when you're back against the wall and everybody's killing you, then it's a natural instinct to take something in your own hand and kill. And I think if there is organized violence against poor people, as there is in many parts of India, then organized counter-violence is completely logical. But the illogic of it, as I said before, is the fact that there is no end to that violence, because once you pick up the gun, and once the state picks up its guns and the police get violent, and we've seen it in Manipur, we've seen it in Andhra, we've seen it in parts of the tribal areas of Jharkhand, we are beginning to see it there, we've seen it in Bihar. What is the end? What is the end? And in Hyderabad, there has been a group which has tried to get both parties, the state as well as the Naxalites, to put down their arms, because you cannot work except in an atmosphere of peace for development of people and mankind. So at some point, there is a dilemma which I think one should resolve. But I do also think that there are other ways and probably more ways of solving this. And together we should try and find out ways in which we can do it. And there are areas in which we are now seeking alliances, like the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, which the government has passed in India, where the extreme left is also interested in seeing that the act is implemented. So let's see if we can find more grounds where we can work with peace and understand that the pain of people who have been oppressed for centuries, and not damn them and condemn them for using violence, but also understand the limits of violence.
There, I think that we're going to have to stop with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Aruna Roy, a community activist. She makes her home in India, in Rajasthan, the northwestern part of India in that state. She's been involved as a community activist for a number of years now. She was one of the people who helped start a non-party people's organization called the Association of Workers and Peasants, and also has been quite well-known and very influential in the effort to get Right to Information Acts enacted on the state level in India and also nationally in India. She's here visiting campus for the 15th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. That was last night on the U of I campus, honoring Dan Sanders, who was one time the head of the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois. Dr. Roy, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Well, the only thing I'd like to say is I'm not a doctor.
Oh, that was honorary then. Consider
okay,
that
thank
an
you
honorary doctorate.
Thank you.
Aruna Roy, our guest this morning.